And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute, as they search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And my gosh, is it a 24-hour job, Seth?
Well, for the computers it is.
Oh, yeah.
Not so much for the personnel.
And most of these people, were they all interested in science when they were little kids?
Well, of course, I don't really know, but if you talk to them, to the extent that I've done that, yes, they almost all were. I mean, I guess they all were. But, you know, my low-grade theory on this is that somewhere between the ages of 8 and 11, you become interested in something. And those are usually your lifelong interests. And, you know, when I talk to astronomers, when did you build a telescope, or when did you first look through a telescope, or, you know, and it's always between the ages of 8 and 11.
Okay, let's take some calls here for you as they roll in. Let's start with Henry in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Henry, thanks for calling.
I'm curious about the alcohol formed naturally in space, and if Seth has anything to say about that.
The alcohol in space? Tell me more about that, Henry. What do you mean?
Okay, well, it's not like, you know, there's a Budweiser still or Jack Daniels still out there.
Right.
Okay. So we need to think about this as the chemical, carbon, hydrogen, I don't know. It's a big one, the chew. And it appears to be showing up on all these nebula. And I'm just curious about Seth's input on that.
All right. Seth, do you know anything about that?
Yeah. Well, that's the whole problem, of course, that it's not in cans or bottles or anything else. But there's a lot of it. And Henry's absolutely right. I mean, there have been hundreds, well, I think close to 200, I'm not sure the current tally, of molecules found in space. They tend to be relatively simple molecules. You may say alcohol is not all that simple, but it's, you know, it's, I don't know, 7 or 10 atoms. So that's relatively simple compared to something like DNA. And these are formed in the cold regions of space because if you have gases in space that want to get together and, you know, form a more complex molecules, which they like to do, that can't be in a warm part of the galaxy because, you know, if it's near a hot star or something like that, the heat from the star will sort of break up the molecules. But, you know, in the dark inner regions of galactic clouds filled with dust where there isn't any strong sunlight or starlight, then these molecules form. And the way we can see them, you may wonder, well, how do you know there's alcohol there? The way you know is that alcohol, all molecules, they tend to vibrate. They vibrate very, very quickly, of course. And when they vibrate, they can emit either light or radio waves. And quite a few of these molecules emit radio waves at a given frequency, given spot on the dial. And so radio astronomers for 30 or 40 years now have been tuning their receivers to these frequencies and finding all sorts of molecules in space. It's just, you know, it's what's out there.
Don't you need something organic to create alcohol?
No, not necessarily. You can make alcohol. Are you planning? I mean,
no, yeah, I've got my still in the backyard there.
Since it's still in the night.
It's called SETI. It's
yeah. No, you don't need to have. I mean, it is an organic molecule, but the definition of an organic molecule, chemistry is not my strongest suit, but is that there's carbon in it. So you might say, well, is coal, is that organic? Well, it is, actually. But, you know, if it has carbon in it, strictly speaking, you can call it an organic molecule. But and so, of course, alcohol, which does have carbon in it, is an organic molecule. But most of the molecules are, you know, simple things like hydroxyl radicals and stuff like that. So there's just a lot of them. And I've known several people who've made a living by studying these molecules in space.
Interesting for Henry to pick that up, though. East of the Rockies, Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Seth, a couple of questions. First, when space probes are sent, some of them are sent, you know, orbiting Mercury for, you know, 400 days or whatever, and 4 years. How is contact maintained? Is that sound based? Talking about sound with those probes, and in terms of the layout of the solar system, the planets, the spacing, the moon, is pretty large in relation to the Earth, only one moon. What's your opinion as to the layout of the solar system? What surprises you about that? And also, have you met a man, one of the men in black?
Well, that's three questions, Joe.
Not two.
you may have to pay extra for that last one. The only men in black I've ever met, well, I actually think George usually wears black, at least when I've seen him.
Yes, I do. You're right.
So there you go. There's your man in black right there. As far as contact with the probes, yeah, I mean, these probes go out, well, they go all over the solar system, and some of them have even left the solar system. And the way you maintain communications with them, and you do want that because, you know, if they're making measurements or pictures or whatever of Pluto as they fly by, just to name one, you know, it doesn't do you any good unless you can get that data back to Earth. So they radio it back. It's sent back by radio at pretty high frequencies. And NASA has some big antennas just outside of Los Angeles in the desert there that they use for picking up these signals. Other antennas are sometimes used as well. As far as the layout of the solar system...
Any surprises there?
Well, we don't know, because you can't say that it's unusual or normal until you've looked at a lot of other solar systems. And this is the generation that's going to be able to do that. We've found lots and lots of planets around other star systems, but it's still very hard to find, you know, relatively small planets like Mercury. You mentioned Mercury or Venus or Earth or Mars. Those are still hard to find. And so until we have better instruments that can do that, you can't say whether our solar system is just another duck in the row or it's not a duck at all.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's truly remarkable. But it's remarkable, the complexity and the simplicity all at the same time, isn't it?
Well, it is. And people have set it to music. And, you know, there are all sorts of sort of, relationships called, well, people might want to look this up. I don't remember. Never mind that.
You were the one who said something to me years ago that I've never forgotten. I quote it all the time when we talk about the possibility of life out there in the universe. And you said the primordial soup is the same everywhere. You remember that?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the great triumphs of astronomy, perhaps. In the last 500 years, when you say, well, what has astronomy learned that was really revolutionary? I mean, there are all sorts of things like, you know, how do stars work? I mean, that wasn't solved until very recently, actually. But perhaps the single most important thing is that astronomy has taught us that, okay, the universe is vast, much bigger than we ever thought. But no matter how far away you look or how far back in time you look, the physics is all the same. The whole universe is built with the same recipe. And that's interesting.
Let's go to Cheryl in Washburn, Missouri, Wildcard Line. Hi, Cheryl.
Hey, George. Hey, Seth.
Good to have you with us. Sure thing.
Okay, this whole thing with the interview that you had with Stanford, I don't know. That's like maybe a transition kind of thing. That's a trip.
It was something, I'll tell you.
I know, really. If you could replay that, it'd be amazing. And then deal with, like, Seth, a long time ago, whenever I first got a computer, like 1998, 1999, I ran a SETI program on my computer. I remember that. That was so cool. And I want to thank you so much for your research, the time you've invested. It's amazing. Both of you, actually. It's very cool.
That's kind of you, Cheryl. I think you're probably referring to SETI at Home, which
that's
was
right.
The screensaver program. That was set up, actually, by the University of California.
Tying in all these computers, right?
Right, exactly. You know, when your computer's just sitting there keeping the, you know, the desk warm or something, I mean, you might as well have it do something. And it was the idea of a fellow up in Seattle, actually, in the Seattle area, to have them reduce SETI data. In other words, to process SETI data and look for signals. And for a long time, that program ran, more than a decade, I think there were at least 7 million people who were running the program.
How old were you, Seth, when you got your first telescope?
Well, I built one from parts that I bought from a company in New Jersey, and I think I was 9 or 10.
Oh, my gosh. And you remember going out in the cold New Jersey? Where were you born?
I was born in Virginia, and I, at that time, was living in Virginia, but northern Virginia occasionally got cold.
It got cold at night. I was from Detroit. And I think I must have been about 10. My dad bought me a telescope from a telescope shop in Dearborn, Michigan. It was on Michigan Avenue. And he asked me if I wanted to join a telescope club that the little company put together. And I said, absolutely. And I remember going there, and I had a wooden tripod for my telescope.
Right.
And the guy who owned the place said, well, we want to do something really cool for you. So bring your tripod to your first meeting. And I went, okay. So I bring this telescope and the tripod. They paint the tripod black, and then all of these guys and kids are speckling white paint, and it looks like little stars all over the place on the base of the tripod. And it was so cool. I'll never forget it.
That is amazing. For a while, I had a telescope without a tripod at all, and that was really tough.
How did you do it?
Well, I would just sit on the grass with the telescope sort of lying in my lap and try and hold it steady. But, you know, I used eyepieces that had very low magnification.
And did it have the little finder eyepiece, too, on the side?
It did have a finder on the side. It was never lined up with the main telescope, but in principle, it could have worked.
I remember looking at the rings of Saturn, which was one of the first things I looked at with the telescope at night. And I just couldn't believe it. It looked like somebody had painted that out there in the universe.
Yeah. I hear that actually a lot, George, that you talk to people who are professional astronomers or whatever, and you say, what turned you on? And they'll say, well, when I looked through somebody's telescope at Saturn.
Yeah, those rings at Saturn, when you just look at, you know, wasn't the face on Mars or on the moon, it wasn't the craters that you could see, which were enormous with a telescope.
Right.
But when you saw the rings around Saturn, it was just awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
And then the four moons of Jupiter's 12 or 100 moons, how many they have now, those four big moons that you could see by Jupiter, that was special too.
It is. Apparently there are some people with extremely good eyesight who claim they can see at least a couple of those moons without any telescope. So
let's go to Walter in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Walt, go ahead.
Hi, George. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you, sir.
George, I just want to compliment you on having occasionally someone of the stature of Dr. Shostak on. He's obviously of the caliber of Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And
oh,
Dr.
yeah, he's way up there, Walt.
Georgia, I just, you know, I don't want to brag, but I got straight A's in organic chemistry, advanced organic chemistry, biochemistry. I just want to say that.
Go ahead and brag. Go brag.
Well, alcohols are among the simplest hydrocarbons in the universe. There's methane, and ethane is what is that's the wood alcohol. That's what we imbibe in our
booze.
And the simplest hydrocarbon is formaldehyde, which is just CH2O. It's just the carbon atom that's forced in with the water.
That's what they use to embalm people, isn't it?
Yeah, technically, when they say you're embalmed with formaldehyde, actually formaldehyde, chemically, it cannot exist without being in an aqueous solution. In other words, it's just carbon atoms that are forced into water. Hmm. And in other words, there's no such thing as absolutely pure formaldehyde. It's actually what the embalming solution that the undertakers use. It's a mixture. It's called formalin. It's a mixture of formaldehyde and also what they call acetaldehyde. And there's also some of it is just regular vinegar, really, which is acetaldehyde.
Walter, you know your chemistry, Walter.
Well, you know, Georgia. They didn't send me to college for nothing, hopefully, George. So, you know, I try to enlighten the show in some way. So I'm gratified that I do that occasionally.
All right. So, well, thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Interesting, isn't that, Seth?
It is. And I'm glad that he said that alcohol was a simple molecule, because I was afraid that it, you know, might have had 50 atoms in it or something.
What fascinates you about space?
Well, you know, I think it's the romance of it, really. I mean, it's like, I don't know, being out on the Pacific on a boat, you know, a cruise, whatever, and you look out in the evening at the expanse of water, and it can't help but make an impression upon you about how much how big it is and all that water. And now that sounds kind of dumb, and it is, but you know, you look up at the sky and you're looking at stuff that's old, far away, and completely unlike where you are. And it's, I don't know, it's just, there's this, it's like seeing Oz, the city of Oz, but above your head at night.
I was looking at the full moon a couple days ago, and it was just gorgeous, Seth.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, I've never seen it look that big.
Well, it tends to look bigger when it's near the horizon.
Yeah, exactly. It gets a little smaller. Why is that? Is that an optical illusion?
Yep. Yeah, it's called the moon illusion, curiously enough. And, yeah, because you can build a little device, just a periscope with a couple of mirrors, and, you know, when the moon is near the horizon, you look through this thing, and if you build it right, then it'll show the moon being above your head, right? It sort of just moves the moon around. And it turns out if you think it's above your head, it doesn't look as big anymore. It's your brain.
Super. Mark in Austin, Texas. Let's get you in before the break, Mark.
Hello, George and Dr. Shostak.
Oh, there.
Dr. Shostak, I'd like to know what you might think of Irving Siegel's chronometric cosmology, which, if true, would mean that all life in the universe is closer to us and has had a much longer time to evolve and send signals to us than in popular alternative cosmologies.
Are you familiar with Siegel's work at all, Seth?
I can't say I am. I mean,
Nor am I.
Enlighten me enough to at least address the question.
Nor am I. Who is the guy, Mark?
Yes, Irving Siegel worked at the Institute for Advanced Studies in about 1940, and he picked up on Einstein's 1917 proposal that the spatial part of our universe is a three-sphere. And in 1989, Siegel fit some observed data to estimate that the radius of our universe is about a little over 500 million light years, and that the furthest point from us in the universe, our so-called antipode, is about 1.6 billion light years from us.
Mark, you know your stuff. We'll check into this guy.
Yeah,
and,
but he was wrong on those numbers, Mark, right?
Probably.
Yeah, no, definitely. But that doesn't mean the cosmology's wrong. Maybe the math was good.
Galileo, would you have liked to have met him?
I think I would. It certainly would have improved my Italian. I would have liked to have met
Galileo. Of course, you could be the reincarnated Galileo, for all I know, right?
Well, I've been within 5 feet, or maybe it was 10, of Galileo. But, of course, he was behind, you know, the wall of his crypt. So, you know, he wasn't holding up his side of the conversation. But he was a really clever guy, and, you know, we still remember what he did. And even though it was, you know, centuries ago, and that can't be said of many of the people who were around when Galileo was.
Seth, we're going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with you here, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Seth's website, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. On our next Coast to Coast program, of course, we're going to talk about some mystical things, so make sure you're part of the program. And by the way, a little note, Easter is this Sunday. We will have a live show for you on Easter night, so make sure you're part of the program as well. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our final segment with Seth Shostak from SETI. Let's go to the phones. First-time caller Daniel in Lakewood, California with us. Hey, Daniel, go ahead.
Hi. I've been dying to ask this question to someone knowledgeable. Has any SETI research or radio telescopes been aimed and pointed at the Zeta Reticuli binary star system? And if so, have any signals been?
All right, good question. Has it ever been pointed out in that direction, Seth?
Yes, indeed. It was on one of our first observing runs, I think, down in Puerto Rico, actually. We looked at Zeta Reticuli, but we didn't hear anything, by the way. But, you know, I don't think we really expected to, because Zeta Reticuli, it has a, you know, I guess it's the Betty and Barney Hill story.
Right? That's right, exactly.
But the thing is, if you actually look at the astronomical properties of Zeta Reticuli, it's a fairly new star. When I say fairly new, maybe 50 million years or something like that. Anyhow, it's not a very old star. And that means that even if there's a planet with life on it around that star system, it hasn't had very much time to evolve beyond being a single-celled organism to something as clever as a Klingon.
Next up, Russ is in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Russell, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys.
Hey, Russ.
I tuned my radio at night to a static on 875 megahertz. And one night, my radio went terribly loud. The volume went crazy. And I noticed there was a flying saucer. Excuse me. A UFO went flying by outside.
What do you think of that, Seth?
Well, Russ, all I can tell you is I can't tell you much because I wasn't there and I didn't hear it. But, you know, if you're tuning to anything below about 1 gigahertz, right, which is 1,000 megahertz, so you were tuned to, you said, 875 megahertz. That's by the way, pretty high frequency. I'm not sure what kind of radio you got there, but it's, you know, it's got to be a special one. But, you know, there's just all this interference from human activity, right? I mean, these high frequencies that you're speaking of here, they're used for all sorts of things, including your cell phone, by the way. So the fact that you pick something up in a loud noise, you know, that doesn't mean too much. The fact that you seem to have picked it up when something untoward roared by, I mean, maybe that does mean something, but, you know, then we need to figure out what it was that went by you.
Absolutely. Seth, I want you to stay safe, my friend, and hopefully one day we'll get together at some live event, okay?
I hope so, George.
Thank you very much. Seth Sostak from SETI, what a wonderful individual and just a great organization searching for extraterrestrial life out there. Now, I happen to believe we've been visited, but they continue to search for it, so that is truly remarkable. Edgar Allan Poe, great author, wrote some incredibly horrid stories that would scare the living daylights out of you. And I was asked a few years ago to do a rendition of his Telltale Heart. So here it is.
The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous, I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object there was none. Passion there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad? Madmen know nothing. But you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed. Closed, that no light shone out, and then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening, so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ah, would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight, but I found the eye always closed, and so it was impossible to do the work. For it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone, and inquiring how he has passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man, indeed, to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the eighth night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with the thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers, and so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on, steadily, steadily. I had my head in, and was about to open the lantern, when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed listening, just as I have done, night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew this sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it was welled up from my own bosom, deepening, with its dreadful echo, the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise, when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor, or it is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with all these suppositions, but he had found all in vain. All in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, until at length a simple dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot from out the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with a perfect distinctness, all a dull blue, with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray, as if by instinct, precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the sense? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eve. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder. I say louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous. So I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone, stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there for many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His Eve would trouble me no more. If you still think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the board so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out. No stain of any kind, no blood spot, whatever. I had been too wary for that. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart. For what had I now to fear? There entered three men, who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled. For what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search, search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But still they sat and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definiteness until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice. Yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such as a sound a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards. But the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no, no. They heard, they suspected, they knew, they were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now, again, hark! Louder! 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 Villains, I shrieked, dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here! Here! It is the beating of his hideous heart.
Oh, boy. For Dan Galante, Donna Walker, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.